I perceive mental pictures in myself, in the same way that I perceive colors, sounds, and so forth in other objects. From this point of view, I can now make a distinction, calling these other objects that stand over against me the outer world, while designating the content of my self-percept as the inner world. Failure to recognize the relation between the mental picture and the object has led to the greatest misunderstandings in modern philosophy. The perception of an inner change, the modification that myself undergoes, has been thrust into the foreground, and the object causing this modification has been lost sight of altogether. It has been said that we do not perceive objects, but only our mental pictures. I am not supposed to know anything of the object of my observation, the table in itself, but only of the change that occurs in myself while I perceive the table. This view must not be confused with the Barclayan view mentioned above. Barclay asserts the subjective nature of my perceptual content, but he does not say that I can know only my mental pictures. He limits my knowledge to my mental pictures because he believes that there are no objects outside mental picturing. In this view, once I cease directing my gaze toward it, what I regard as a table no longer exists. Hence, for Barclay, my percepts arise immediately from the power of God. I see a table because God calls forth this percept in me. Barclay knows of no real beings other than God and human spirits. What we call the world is present only within spirits. What the naive human being calls the outer world, corporeal nature, does not exist for Barclay. Barclay's view stands in contrast to the currently prevailing Kantian view. This also limits our knowledge of the world to our mental pictures, but it does not do so because of the conviction that no things except these mental pictures can exist. Rather, the Kantian view believes us to be so organized that we can learn only of modifications in our own self, not of the things in themselves that cause them. From the circumstance that I know only my mental pictures, the Kantian view draws the conclusion not that there is no existence independent of these mental pictures, but only that the subject cannot directly receive such an existence into itself. This view then concludes that only through, quote, the medium of its subjective thoughts can it imagine, fantasize, think, cognize, or even perhaps fail to cognize, unquote, this existence. This Kantian view believes it is saying something absolutely certain, something that is immediately evident without any proof. Quote, the first fundamental proposition that the philosopher must bring to clear consciousness consists in the recognition that our knowledge does not initially extend beyond our mental pictures. Our mental pictures are the only things that we know directly, experience directly. And just because we experience them immediately, even the most radical doubt cannot tear from us our knowledge of them. By contrast, the knowledge that goes beyond our mental pictures, I use this expression in its widest sense so that it includes all psychical events, is not safe from doubt. Here, at the start of philosophizing, all knowledge that goes beyond mental pictures must be explicitly posited as open to doubt. End of quote. This is how Foucault's book, Immanuel Kant's Epistemology, begins. But what is presented in it, as if it were an immediate and self-evident truth, is really the result of the following kind of thought process. Quote, the naive human being believes that objects, just as we perceive them, also exist outside human consciousness. But physics, physiology, and psychology seem to teach that our organization is necessary for our perceptions, and that consequently we cannot know anything about things other than what our organization transmits to us. Hence our percepts are modifications of our organization, and not things in themselves. End quote. I think that's Steiner sort of speaking. Edward von Hartmann characterizes this train of thought as necessarily leading to the conviction that we can have direct knowledge only of our mental pictures. Because we find outside our organism vibrations of bodies and of the air that appear to us as sound, this view reasons that what we call sound is nothing more than a subjective reaction of our organization to these vibrations in the outer world. In the same way, color and warmth are all only modifications of our organism. According to this view, the percepts of warmth and color are evoked in us by the effects of processes in the outer world that are utterly different from our experience of warmth or color. When these processes stimulate the nerves in my skin, I have the subjective percept of warmth. When they stimulate the optic nerve, I perceive light and color. Light, color, and warmth are therefore what my sense nerves create as responses to outside stimuli. Even the sense of touch presents me not with objects of the external world, but only with my own states. Following modern physics, we might think that the body consists of infinitesimal particles, molecules, and that these molecules do not border one another immediately, but are a certain distance apart. Between them, then, is empty space. They affect one another through this space by means of forces of attraction and repulsion. When I bring my hand near a body, the molecules of my hand never touch those of the body immediately. There always remains a certain distance between body and hand. What I feel as the resistance of the body is nothing more than the effect of the repellent force that its molecules exist on my hand. I am completely outside the body in question, and merely perceive its effect on my organism. To complete these considerations, we have the teaching of the so-called specific sense energies proposed by J. Müller. According to this theory, our senses have the peculiar quality that each sense responds to all external stimuli in only one specific fashion. If a stimulus is applied to the optic nerve, then the percept of light arises, whether the excitation occurs through what we call light, through mechanical pressure, or through an electrical current impinging on the nerve. On the other hand, the same external stimuli evoke different percepts in the different senses. It appears to follow from this that our senses can transmit only what occurs within them, and transmit nothing from the outer world. The senses determine the percepts according to their nature. Physiology shows that there can also be no direct knowledge of what effect objects have within our sense organs. When physiologists follow the processes in our own body, they find the effects of an external motion already transformed within the sense organs in the most various ways. We see this most clearly in the eye and the ear. Both are very complicated organs which fundamentally alter an external stimulus before bringing it to the corresponding nerve. From the peripheral nerve ending, the already modified stimulus is now led on to the brain. Here the central organs must in turn be stimulated. From this the conclusion is drawn that the external process undergoes a series of transformations before coming to consciousness. What goes on in the brain is connected to the external process through so many intermediate processes that we cannot imagine any similarity between them. What the brain then finally transmits to the soul are neither external processes nor processes in the sense organs, but only processes within the brain. Yet even these the soul does not perceive directly. What we ultimately have in consciousness are not brain processes at all, but sensations. My sensation of red has no similarity to the process occurring in the brain when I sense redness. Redness emerges again only as an effect in the soul and is caused by the brain process alone. Therefore, Hartmann says, quote, "What the subject perceives are, therefore, always only modifications of its own psychic states and nothing else." Unquote. When I have the sensations, however, these are still far from being grouped into what I perceive as things. After all, only individual sensations can be transmitted to me through the brain. Sensations of hardness and softness are transmitted to me through the sense of touch, color and light through the sense of sight. Yet these are united in one and the same object. Such union, then, can only be effected by the soul itself. That is, the soul assembles separate sensations transmitted by the brain into bodies, My brain conveys to me separately and by altogether different pathways sensations of sight, taste, and hearing that the soul then combines into the mental picture of a trumpet. This final stage of a process, the mental picture of the trumpet, is given to my consciousness as the very first. In it nothing may be found of what is outside me and originally made the impression on my senses. On the way to the brain and through the brain to the soul, the external object has been completely lost. It would be hard to find another edifice of thought in the history of human culture that has been constructed with more ingenuity and that nevertheless on closer scrutiny collapses into nothing. Let us look more closely at how this edifice has been built up. It begins with what is given to naive consciousness of the thing perceived. Then it shows that everything found there would be non-existent for us if we had no senses, no eye, no color. So color is not yet present in what affects the eye. It first arises through the interaction of the eye with the object, I-E-Y-E. The object, then, is colorless. But the color is not present in the I-Y-E either. In the eye there is a chemical or physical process that is first led through the nerve to the brain, where it sets off another process. This process is still not yet color. It is only through the brain process that the color is evoked in the soul. There, it still does not yet enter my consciousness, but is first transferred outward by the soul on to the body, a body. Finally, I believe I am perceiving it there. We have come full circle. We have become conscious of a colored body. That comes first. Now the thought operation begins. If I had no eyes, the body would be colorless for me. Therefore, I cannot attribute color to the body. I go looking for it. I look for it in the eye, in vain. In the nerve, also in vain. In the brain, again, in vain. Finally, I look for it in the soul. There I find it, to be sure, but unconnected with the body. I find the colored body only where I began. The circle has been closed. I recognize as the product of my soul what the naive human being imagines as externally present in space. As long as we keep to this, everything seems to fit beautifully. But we must begin again, at the beginning. After all, so far, I have been dealing with an entity, the external percept, of which, as a naive human being, I had an altogether false view. I believed that it had an objective permanence just as I perceived it. Now I notice that it disappears with my mental picturing, that it is only a modification of my own soul states. Do I still have the right to take it as a starting point for my reflections? Can I say that it has an effect on my soul? From now on I must treat the table itself, which I used to believe affected me and produced a mental picture of itself within me, as a mental picture. But then, to be consistent, my sense organs and the processes in them must also be only subjective. I have no right to speak of a real I, E-Y-E, only of my mental picture of the I. And it is the same with nerve conduction and brain processes, and no less so with the process in the soul itself by which things are supposedly built up out of the chaos of the various sensations. If I run through the elements of the act of cognition once again, assuming the correctness of that first circuit of thoughts, then the cognitive act reveals itself as a tissue of mental pictures that as such can have no effect on one another. I cannot say my mental picture of the object has an effect on my mental picture of the eye, and from this interaction there proceeds the mental picture of the color. Nor do I need to do so. For as soon as it is clear to me that even my sense organs and their activities, the processes of my nerves and soul, can be given only through perception, then the above train of thought reveals itself in its perfect impossibility. So much is correct, then. I can have no percept without the corresponding sense organ, but neither can I have a sense organ without perception. I can pass from my percept of the table to the eye that sees it, or to the nerves in the skin that touch it, But what takes place within these I can learn once again only through perception. Then I soon notice that there is no trace of similarity between the process occurring in the eye and what I perceive as color. I cannot deny my color percept by pointing to the process in the eye that takes place during this perception. Nor can I find the color in the nerve and brain processes. I only connect new percepts within my organism to the first percept, which the naive person places outside the organism. I only pass from one percept to the next. Moreover, there is a gap in the whole train of argument. I am in a position to follow the processes within my organism up to the process in my brain, even though my assumptions become ever more hypothetical the closer I come to its central processes. The path of external observation ends with the process in my brain. More precisely, it ends with what I would perceive if I could examine the brain with physical and chemical means and methods. The path of inner observation begins with sensation and goes as far as the construction of things from the material of sensation. At the point of transition from brain process to sensation, the path of observation is interrupted. This way of thinking, which calls itself critical idealism, in contrast to the standpoint of naive consciousness, which it calls naive realism, makes the error of characterizing one percept as a mental picture while accepting another percept in exactly the same way as the naive realism it had ostensibly refuted. Critical idealism seeks to prove that percepts have the character of mental pictures, while naively accepting the percepts of one's own organism as objectively valid facts. What is more, it fails to notice that it is throwing together two fields of observation between which it can find no connection. Critical idealism can only refute naive realism if, in naive realist fashion, it accepts one's own organism as something that exists objectively. The moment it becomes aware that the percepts connected to one's own organism and those assumed by naive realism to exist objectively are completely equivalent, it can no longer base itself on the former as if on a sure foundation. It is forced to regard its own subjective organization, too, as a mere complex of mental pictures. But thereby the possibility of thinking that the content of the perceived world is caused by our mental organization is lost. We would have to assume that the mental picture color was only a modification of the mental picture I, EYE. So-called critical idealism cannot be proved without borrowing from naive realism, while naive realism can be refuted only by accepting its own presuppositions, unexamined in another sphere. This much, then, is certain. Investigation in the perceptual realm can neither prove critical idealism nor strip the percept of its objective character. Still less can the proposition, quote, the perceived world is mental picture, unquote, be hailed as self-evident and in need of no proof. Schopenhauer begins his main work, The World as Will and Representation, or Mental Picture, with the words, quote, the world is my mental picture. This truth applies to every living and cognizing being, though human beings alone can bring it into reflected abstract consciousness. And when they actually do so, then philosophical understanding has dawned upon them. It is then clear and evident that we know no sun and no earth, but always only an eye that sees a sun, a hand that feels the earth. That the world around us is present only as a mental picture, that is only in relation to something that pictures it, namely ourselves. If any truth may be asserted a priori, it is this one, for it expresses the one form of all possible and conceivable experience that is more universal than any other, than time, space, and causality, for all of these presuppose it. End quote. End quote. This whole proposition collapses in the face of the fact noted above that the eye and hand are percepts no less than the sun and the earth. And thus, in Schopenhauer's sense, and using his style of expression, we could answer, my eye which sees the sun and my hand which feels the earth are mental pictures in exactly the same way as the sun and the earth are. With this insight, and without further ado, it is clear that I cancel out Schopenhauer's proposition. For only my real eye and my real hand could have the mental pictures of sun and earth as their modifications, but my mental pictures of eye and hand could not. Yet critical idealism can speak only of these mental pictures. Critical idealism is completely unable to gain insight into the relationship of percepts and mental pictures. It cannot begin to make the distinction mentioned above, page 59, between what happens to the percept during the process of perceiving and what must already be present in it before it is perceived. To do this, we must take a different path.